7. Billary. As soon as Mr. Clinton became the president, Mrs. Clinton and her staff sought to repair the Clinton brand among groups they thought had been damaged during the campaign, scheduling galas, balls, and dinners. They hosted open house tours day and night, especially around Christmas and for the military. What she and her staffers failed to realize was that the White House had a budget like any other government entity. Each shindig still had to be paid, either from the executive residence budget or the Democratic Party's purse. Event planners dropped the ball on costs. One Rose Garden event required big, rented air-conditioned tents that ruined the lawn. Landscaping crews in the National Park Service tore up all the dead grass, installed new sod, and sent them the bill. That's expensive. But you can't just have a whole White House lawn muddy and looking like crap. Just get it done, staffers would say. Party rental companies refused future events until they were paid. The discussions were plain embarrassing, but when I heard them, I wasn't eavesdropping. They were shouted in the hallway. The Clintons believed that a magic royal pot of money somehow existed for their every whim. The Bush administration had upgraded the White House telecommunications system. It wasn't easy. Imagine an elaborate phone system wired into a building built when the only common utility was plumbing. The Clinton staff upgraded it yet again. The catch? The Clinton administration hadn't anticipated that it had to actually pay for things, and the bill blindsided them. We heard about this both from the West Wing staffers talking or yelling about it, and from the AT&T technicians we escorted about the building. These technicians further revealed to us that the new administration believed that Republicans in the Bush operation had tapped the White House system to listen in on them. The vice president's residence is at the Naval Observatory on Massachusetts Avenue, a few blocks from the White House. Technicians at the control center of the technical service were surprised to see alarms going off at the house. First carbon monoxide, then heat alarms, then other alarms. Even the radiation alarm. Something was seriously amiss. SAs and UD officers immediately responded, letting themselves in. They found Vice President Al Gore standing on a chair, pulling an alarm out of the ceiling, looking for hidden cameras and listening devices. Early on, the staff kept promising payments, but it was common knowledge that they had no idea of where they were coming from. But the buck kept getting passed because Mrs. Clinton didn't want to hear no, and no one wanted to be the bearer of bad news. Evergreen was spoiled. Her doting, barely post-adolescent staffers resembled enabling, weak-willed parents. She threw massive tantrums. As her husband's term continued, those tantrums and her attitude toward us and various White House staff worsened. Years later, I read George Stephanopoulos' memoir, All Too Human. I was amazed at how candid it was. It was a page-turner, bringing many bad memories rushing back. He wrote, "When Hillary was angry, you didn't always know it right away. A calculated chill would descend over time. Bill Clinton's anger was a more impersonal physical force, like a tornado. The tantrum would form in an instant and exhaust itself in a violent rush. Whoever happened to be in the way would have to deal with it. More often than not, that person was me. While I often saw the president fume, I rarely saw him become irate. Meanwhile, I often saw, heard, or heard about the First Lady's volcanic eruptions at UD officers, SAs, especially on her own detail, and all the people who worked at the White House." I laughed at Stephanopoulos' take because it seemed we witnessed opposite things. While the president must have vented his frustrations to the staff, Mrs. Clinton vented on everyone, and it got worse the more at home she felt in the White House. Most of us knew to brace for her inevitable eruptions. They didn't happen every day, but behind closed doors, we learned about them fast. In public, she was everyone's best friend. Privately, she was her normal self. It was early September 1995. I had seen the news like everyone else. The night before, a Metro police officer had alleged that George Stephanopoulos was in the midst of a hit and run when the officer stopped him and administered a breathalyzer test for alcohol. George's car was usually parked on West Executive, for weeks at a time, it seemed, because he hardly drove. It had dings all around and a busted taillight. The past night, he'd busted another. George arrived in his office, attracting a group of young strap-hanger female staffers, along with his assistant, Laura. According to George, in Almost Human, I had been arrested in Georgetown. The charge was hit and run. The truth was that I couldn't maneuver my car out of a tight parking spot on M Street. When I scraped the bumper ahead of me, an excitable police officer who happened by recognized me and made a scene, patting me down as a crowd gathered around. More bad luck, I had carelessly let my license expire. He cuffed my hands behind my back and called in four cars to take me to the station. Although my car never left the curb, I was cited for leaving the scene of an accident. Several hours later, I was released with an apology from the station chief, and the charges were dropped. But the damage was done. Video footage of my arrest was all over the morning news. I mean, who does this cop think he is? You know, typical a-hole cop, he continued in the office. I barely nudged the car. They just had to call four cars over. He was just like all the other staffers we had either kicked out or had an issue with. They had pushed the envelope too far, and the Leos knew it was going to be a political heavyweight battle afterward. George blustered, which was typical. It never surprised me. The Clinton people seemed to regard police and military personnel as if we had some grand conspiracy on them, as if we had a most wanted deck of playing cards with their faces on it. From the way I knew George, I was sure instead of the officers recognizing George, it was George who played the "Do you know who I am?" game. George kept dragging out the story, talking so loudly that everyone in the hallway could hear him. Laura saw me snickering in the hallway, tensed up, and tried to flag George off the story, which made it even funnier for me. "Hey, George," I said. "I understand that you had an interesting weekend." All the girls looked so awkward. He shrugged me off, and I left laughing. He didn't care, and I knew he, like so many others in the White House, had lost the ability to see themselves through others' eyes. Laura visited me afterward, ostensibly for small talk, but probably really to apologize. I preempted her by saying that I thought of George's self-importance as merely comical. In a way, it was almost guaranteed that the president would vent to George, while Mrs. Clinton would vent to whoever happened to pull the short straw that day. Take, for example, the morning of Tuesday, June 13, 1995. Just another day at the White House. I answered my phone outside the Oval Office. "Heads up, there's a shitstorm coming your way." "I knew it," I laughed. I'd grown used to such warnings. "Here we go. Evergreen moving toward West Wing," I heard in my ear. Her detail stormed in. I always avoided eye contact when she was on the warpath. Everyone got the hell out of her way. Mrs. Clinton was a joke, taking herself and the entire administration's minutiae so seriously. Her brand was her only concern. She was a faux leader, all bark, no bite, but in a very real power position as First Lady. I thanked God that the Secret Service answered to the Treasury Department and wasn't some private presidential army. "They effed us, Bill," Hillary screamed. I stifled a laugh. The president tried his best to calm her down. He couldn't. Hillary Clinton possessed no perspective. "We need to get rid of these assholes, Bill." She thought she was being tough, in command, but the issue commanded her. She fumed that the Secret Service's uniformed division, my branch, disloyal leftovers from Papa Bush, conspired against the administration. "They've had it out for us from the beginning," she kept yelling. She continued screaming about how we had treated campaign event attendees, a festering, deep-seated grudge that she and many administration types harbored against us and the entire Secret Service. Members of the Presidential Protection Division and her own First Lady Protection Division, as well as I, the UD officer posted to the Oval Office, stood silently by, hearing wave after wave of vitriol wash over us. The door shut. We remained outside, exchanging chuckles and exasperated looks. It's inappropriate to eavesdrop, but with the old building acoustics and how loudly she yelled, it was impossible not to hear. White House acoustics are very strange. Scream inside a room, and everyone in the hallway hears it. Maybe she knew that, but no one dared tell her. Hillary's antics made my job interesting. She'd explode in my face without reservation or decorum, then confide in some visiting VIP, "This is one of my favorite officers, Gary Byrne." She'd put her hand on my shoulder for good measure. I'd smile and nod. But we were like furniture to them. The day of Hillary's screaming, I moved to the edge of my post, not wanting to hear anything or be seen in eavesdrop territory. For 45 minutes, she berated the president. "Man, she hates you guys," whispered one agent. "Of course it's us," I said sarcastically. "It was never their fault." "I can't believe he's defending you guys," said the other. I couldn't believe it either. "You can't just do that," the president kept repeating. She wouldn't take no for an answer, even from him. When she left, I poked my head into Betty Curry's office. "So how'd that go?" I asked. Betty Curry, the president's discreet personal secretary, did her best to ignore the issue. I ducked back outside. Neither the first lady nor the administration staffers possessed any desire to understand our role, or even their own. Mountains of bureaucracy, protocols, and very different American experiences separated us. Name the incident, and instead of trying to understand, she'd yell. But if she'd had her way, we'd have been gone that day. Inconsequential events surrounding a visit from a 40-strong gay rights delegation, led by openly gay Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank, had ignited this morning's rage. They had come to lobby the president, Vice President Gore, and senior staff. During his campaign, President Clinton had promised gays much. Once in office, he delivered "Don't Ask, Don't Tell." They weren't satisfied. The Clintons had to balance their demands with those of the military. But people like Barney Frank and Bill Clinton discredited their own causes. Clinton was secretive, corrupt, and a womanizer. Congressman Frank hired a male prostitute and sexual partner as an aide and driver, albeit with personal funds, not taxpayers. His attaché later ran a male escort service out of the congressman's house in Washington. The House Ethics Committee slapped Congressman Frank on the wrist for fixing some parking tickets and lying about knowing his attaché had a criminal record. That didn't prevent Frank's re-election, and he kept pushing for his cause. But his notoriety was a lightning rod. That prostitution scandal didn't help his reputation. Each member of Frank's delegation was listed as usual in my paperwork. The title of the delegation itself was boldly marked, HIV positive. Our screeners took note of this, and their usual safety precautions immediately increased. As a trained first responder, each day I checked my FAT, first aid and trauma kit, and had my UD-issued blue nitride gloves designed to protect me. It wasn't for AIDS. Casual physical contact doesn't spread the disease. We needed gloves to inspect visitors' bags. Workers' compensation and Department of Health and Human Services rules required us to use this protection because we came in daily contact with tampons, tissues, and certain personal vibrating devices. People's bags were gross, but we had to search them. A prick from a syringe hidden in someone's bag could be life-threatening. It had happened. UD had tried obtaining ballistic search gloves, but the administrators deemed them too expensive and unnecessary. If they had done our jobs, they'd have been wearing astronaut suits. Some guys bought their own search gloves. That morning, a couple of UD officers overdid it, donning their gloves as if they were about to perform a rectal exam. One, I'll call him Krusty, an old-school Vietnam combat veteran, a great guy, made a show of slapping on his blue gloves. Why are you doing that? A visitor demanded. You know why. So the day started off on the wrong foot. But the delegation's real ire resulted from the Clintons having made promises they couldn't keep. Representative Frank's delegation wanted to make waves. They loved being offended. With the glove incident, they got their chance, the PR opportunity of a lifetime. I knew the guys who had checked in Frank's delegation. I'd worked their rotation myself, checking thousands of bags. Joking kept us vigilant. It's counterintuitive, but somehow it kept us alert. Yes, this time it was a bit much. On an outrage scale of 1 to 10, however, this should have been a 1. But remember, if we didn't check everyone for everything, maybe a John Hinckley would get through. That didn't stop the charge of the politically correct brigade. The Baltimore Sun headlined, "Guards don gloves as gay officials visit White House." Other papers screamed similar headlines. Careers were on the line. Our UD leadership promised better training. The Clinton administration demanded that the Secret Service be more user-friendly. Better training? It never happened. Just a big grab-ass in the media, nothing on the ground level. The insinuation of homophobia by the Secret Service as a whole was reckless. And in the push for staying politically correct, they nearly jettisoned the funding for the real training we needed, specifically on how to save lives in truly dangerous friendly fire situations. That wasn't a joke. We'd nearly lost an officer, Scott Giambattista, to friendly fire the previous year. Refer to Chapter 9 for details. They gave us black gloves instead of blue. Some of us finally got the Kevlar and leather ballistic gloves we wanted, so maybe we won. But it took controversy rather than common sense to get things done. But the most revealing portion of the blue glove story was not how a uniformed division officer may or may not have overreacted. It was how people under Mrs. Clinton's direct command had messed up in the first place, how she exhibited her rage in a truly over-the-top, unprofessional manner. Let's return to the memo describing the delegation as HIV positive. Somehow, Frank's delegation had secured a copy of that document, and it was the violation of revealing their personal medical records that outraged its members far more than Krusty and his blue glove act. Now, who prepared that memo? It wasn't the Secret Service. It was the White House Social Office, an operation directly under the command of Hillary Rodham Clinton herself. The Secret Service would never have committed such private medical information to a written document. It knew better than to do that, and certainly better than to label the entire delegation as HIV positive. Mrs. Clinton's own office created the crisis. But who received her obscenity-filled tirades? The Secret Service. But some other people suffered far more than we did. I was working in the East Wing and heading toward the second-floor social office to retrieve an event list for the morning's guests. I spied several clearly agitated members of Mrs. Clinton's staff. Sorry to interrupt. No problem, Gary, one answered. But clearly there was a problem. What is it? Is everything all right? I asked. You don't have to tell me if it's not my business. I'm just making sure everyone is safe. Is there anything that I need to be aware of or pass along? They assured me that I had nothing to worry about security-wise. But they had plenty to worry about First Lady-wise. Mrs. Clinton's mad whirl of special events, special tours, and various other functions, all part of her continuing public relations offensive, had never really slowed down. But each event cost money, and as usual, the White House budget remained at the bursting point. To economize, her staff had engaged several unpaid interns to assist with their functions. This morning's stir, and there was a stir every morning, involved an intern's having botched a huge order for official White House social office invitations, basing the design on a previous draft of copy, not the latest. These were not your run-of-the-mill invitations. They were dispatched to royalty, other foreign leaders, dignitaries, ambassadors, and power players all over the world. They were top of the line and had to be completely redesigned and reordered. I tried advising Mrs. Clinton's distraught staffers to keep the matter in perspective. Surely the White House, the country, had bigger problems than this, even if it was money flushed down the drain. Hey, nobody died. That's not the problem, I was told. Who's going to tell Hillary? Another staffer continued with obvious trepidation. My eyes widened. It wasn't the actual problem that was the issue. It wasn't the waste of taxpayer dollars. It was facing the First Lady's response. Yes, imagine dealing with mega wedding invitations for the world's biggest bridezilla. In this case, none other than Hillary Rodham Clinton. Her staffers had to cover their posteriors, and fast. They explicitly informed me that careers were made or broken on the whim of her wrath, a term I heard often. I backed away much more quickly and silently than I'd arrived. But the question wasn't the waste of tens of thousands of public funds, probably more than my annual salary. The issue wasn't why they had entrusted this task to inexperienced interns and then not properly reviewed their work. The issue, as always, was how do we tell Hillary? Fear reigned among her staff. It made it impossible for them to say no to her. It paralyzed their decisions, and in the end, it created disastrous consequences. I mostly saw Vince Foster in the hallways. He was Mrs. Clinton's personal attaché, a lawyer from Arkansas. Word circulated that she berated him mercilessly. The first time I saw Foster, I figured he wouldn't last a year. He looked uncomfortable and unhappy in the White House. I knew what it was like to be yelled at by superiors, but Mrs. Clinton never hesitated to launch a tirade. Yet her staffers never dared say, "I don't have to take this shit." They reminded me of battered wives, too loyal, too unwilling to acknowledge they'd never assuage her. They had no one to blame but themselves, but they could never admit it. She criticized Foster for failing to get ahead of the constant scandals, for cabinet positions not confirmed, and for the slowness of staffing the White House. Foster eventually took his own life in Fort Marcy Park. In his briefcase was a note torn into 27 pieces, blaming the FBI, the media, the Republicans, even the White House usher's office. A rumor circulated among law enforcement types that contended his suicide weapon had to be repaired in order for the forensics team to fire it, since it wouldn't function for them. Maybe his final shot misaligned the cylinders and later prevented contact with the bullet primers. But that, along with many other public details of the case, carpet fibers on his suit coat, etc., made his case spooky. The last lines of his sparse suicide note read, "I was not meant for the job or the spotlight of public life in Washington. Here, ruining people is considered sport." A UD friend of mine, Hank O'Neill, was posted outside of Foster's office as part of the FBI's investigation of his suicide. Maggie Williams, Mrs. Clinton's always well-dressed chief of staff, physically pushed her way past Hank into Foster's office, arguing that he had no right to block her entrance. She removed boxes that were never recovered. They were destroyed. Congressman bashed Officer O'Neill's integrity, but he held firm. He reported exactly what he saw and didn't make any inferences about it, but they were sure he held some smoking gun and was protecting the Clintons. All I'd been warned of proved true. Working protective details during the election, I sized up the Clinton machine by talking with agents and local police in Arkansas. I wanted to know what to expect. Mrs. Clinton installed her office one floor up, next to the legal department's offices. Staffers scurried to avoid her attention. We exchanged good mornings with President Clinton. With her, we used our best judgment and kept silent. But things grew worse. Around 1993, I befriended the FBI liaison to the White House, Gary Aldrich. Everyone at UD liked Aldrich, even if he was FBI. The Secret Service agents had their normal interagency chip on their shoulder for him, but his stories about interacting with the Clintons were rich. He was basically the ambassador between the lauded and revered Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Clintons' executive branch. For the Clintons, the lines between government and politics were always blurred. "I keep having to tell them," he'd confide in us. "We're not your private investigative service over here. We're the FBI. Aldrich's hunched posture betrayed those frustrations, as though he'd grown weary of throwing up his arms, shrugging his shoulders, and shaking his head while exclaiming, "We just can't conduct these inquiries and checks on whomever they wish, even if they are working for the president." He'd look at us, hoping for a shared sense of disbelief. We'd mirror his look of astonishment and humor. It was as if he was asking for confirmation of his own sanity in a crazy world. We knew the feeling all too well. "They can't just run a check on someone because they want more info on them," Aldrich would tell us. "It's not a good enough reason. And then I have to hear from my people that they're going over my head and contacting others at the FBI directly. It's like, come on, guys, we're just trying to help you." It was all standard Clinton operating procedure. In June 1996, Aldrich's predicament became public knowledge when the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee discovered that the White House Office of Personnel and Security had requested the FBI to conduct more than 900 illegal background checks on its political opponents, many of them former Reagan and Bush appointees. This improper peeking into confidential FBI files began, however, on a rather small numerical scale, with the harassing of 7 White House travel office officials. Hillary wanted these good people fired so their jobs could go to her Arkansas cronies. But it wasn't enough that these employees be fired. They had to be put through the ringer of a series of inquisitorial federal investigations. Gary Aldrich would later write, "Mrs. Clinton used security agencies as a hammer to attack and punish those who stood in her way. The FBI, the Secret Service, and the Internal Revenue Service hounded and then prosecuted 7 innocent men who worked for the White House Travel Office simply because they were standing in the way of Mrs. Clinton's political interests and ambitions. She knew federal investigations would destroy those good men, but she wanted her friends in those slots, and that was all that mattered." Did Hillary ever tell the truth about this scandal? Not exactly. As Ken Starr's successor, Robert Ray, found in 2000, the evidence was insufficient to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that any of Mrs. Clinton's statements and testimony regarding her involvement in the travel office firings were knowingly false. Translate that sentence into English, and I think it pretty clearly says, she's wiggled out of it again. Recall also that all improper snooping was accomplished through the White House Office of Personnel and Security. Its director was a fellow named Craig Livingston, whom Gary Aldrich considered a joke. No one could even quite figure out who had hired Livingston, and certainly nobody wanted to take credit. His security and personnel experience seemed to consist mainly of being a bouncer in a DC nightclub. But rumors swirled that Hillary had hired him, though some said it was Vince Foster. She, of course, denied it. Some of my security friends, Gary Aldrich, however, would later write, thought that this, Livingston's appointment, was Mrs. Clinton's way of showing us that she held no respect for us. This scandal became known as Filegate, just another scandal piled onto the other scandals, from Whitewater to sexual harassment and others. We were learning the only thing that pushed a Clinton scandal out of the public eye was another scandal. One day, UD officers met to review events at their respective posts. A bewildered new officer arrived. "Hey, you'll never believe it, but I passed the first lady and she told me to go to hell." A second young officer responded, "You think that's bad? I passed her on the West Colonnade and all I said was good morning, first lady. She told me go F yourself." "Are you serious?" "Go F yourself," he imitated her, pointing a finger. We were stunned, but not all of us were surprised. Our sergeant challenged him, but another officer soon corroborated his story. Our sergeant was speechless. We assured the rookie that this wasn't the job's normal atmosphere, at least not under the previous administration. The sergeant fumed and called the watch commander, who pushed things up the Secret Service chain of command, who said they'd forward it to Chief of Staff Leon Panetta. The service circulated a memo reminding everyone to report any unusual first family interaction to their supervisors. The new guy, who had earned a Purple Heart fighting the Clintons' war in Somalia, got an apology for the First Lady's actions, but not directly from her, of course. Quite a difference from how Barbara Bush once apologized to my family. Staff morale suffered once more. By now, Hillary's behavior never surprised me. I never let it surprise me. Dr. Ruth Westheimer, yes, that Dr. Ruth, had just visited the president. She claimed she had been the final voice in getting the president to run. Every time she visited, she told us she had been a sniper in the Israeli army's early inception. That's 100% true. If you were an enemy, I could put a bullet right in your chest out at 200 yards, young man, she boasted, thumping me in the chest. It honestly hurt. She's a tiny old lady but with hands like a vice. I wouldn't pick a fight with her. Later, one of Mrs. Clinton's staffers escorted a group of visiting Arkansas VIPs. She ordered me to keep an eye on them while she was scooted elsewhere. I refused. Her request jeopardized security. We weren't even allowed to help with luggage if the first family was struggling, because it would tie up our hands. She kept insisting, emulating Mrs. Clinton's behavior like a caricature. She made a call, and soon my earpiece echoed with an ominous, "Evergreen heading to Oval Office area." The First Lady marched straight up to me. The Arkansas VIPs were still in awe over the Oval Office. "I understand we have a problem here." "No, ma'am, we don't. Ms., the staffer, wants to leave this party unescorted in the Oval Office, and it's simply against protocol. Someone has to escort them at all times while in the White House." Safely beyond the VIP's earshot, Mrs. Clinton oozed her typical hostility. Fending off her tongue lashing, I referred again to my official post protocol. I had to be ready for emergency response. Trouble didn't wait for tours. Someone once dropped dead in my area. I had to act. But this wasn't the first time Mrs. Clinton berated me. She simply didn't understand what the UD did, never bothered to learn about her new surroundings or personnel. She wanted things done. I was there to create a secure environment, and escorting her VIPs prevented that. When she finished slinging expletives, pointing her finger up at me, I'm 6'2 and she's 5'4 tops, and openly threatening my career, I suggested a solution. What I would recommend is that they go to the Roosevelt Room. That way they can be supervised as long as they stay there and I'm not called away. If I'm called away, they will have to be sent back to the West Wing lobby. That's the best I can think of at this time, but they simply can't stay in the Oval Office. Ugh, fine. She stormed off. Her staffer glared at me. I killed their VIPs with kindness, as Roosevelt Room protocol differs from the Oval Office's. I found a framed picture in the president's study and brought it out to them. One of the ladies was in the picture, and the rest were clearly jealous. When the First Lady and her staffer returned, our guests informed Mrs. Clinton how much they enjoyed their time, the pictures, and the stories the officer told of the Roosevelt Room. She grabbed me by the arm, pretending we were the best of friends and that she loved the Secret Service. Her personality adversely affected those entrusted with her safety. If I noticed that a new officer was as high-strung as she was, I'd carefully hint to him or her that perhaps they might seek another assignment. The sense of high drama she exuded would only burn them out, physically or emotionally. Worse, they might overact on the job, or be so stressed out that they would start messing up, might even leave an Uzi submachine gun on the bumper of the presidential limo. That had happened once. It was strange. Hillary Clinton always looked uncomfortable around her husband, let alone anyone else. I can't call her shy, but she was definitely standoffish. She never relaxed. She never allowed herself any off-hours or off-duty candor. I couldn't imagine being like that, always having to say or do the right thing, always calculating. Human beings need confidants, friends, family, people they can relax with, but the First Lady was always wound up, an unhappy captive of her own sense of mission. Opposites attract. That's why, on paper, the first couple was perfectly matched. But their opposites were too opposite. Bill Clinton was friendly and charming with just about everyone besides Hillary. He always seemed to want to give his company extra time. He was very generous that way. Like him or not, share his political ideas or not, find yourself in the same room with him and you are hooked. You can't help but like him. But that was not Hillary. She was clearly all business 24/7. Her private leadership style was based on pure fear and loathing, and I never saw her turn that off. Even in the president's presence, Mrs. Clinton operated at far greater than arm's length. A cheerless grifter, always on her scheming way to someone or something else more important than the person directly in front of her. If you saw them privately, they never seemed to meld at all. But turn on a camera or bring in a fat cat donor, and the ice suddenly melted. They'd smile at each other, laugh, trade little jokes. They'd move in closer to each other, turn warmer, yes, even romantic. They might even hold hands. They could flip that emotional light switch whenever they had to, then switch it back off again when the crowds and cameras departed. It was all a business for them. Clinton, Inc. At a White House event for agents and their wives, the Clintons invited UD officers who worked closely in the West Wing, and I was honored to be included. The agents weren't too thrilled, which made it that much sweeter. It was a big deal to Jenny. As usual, the first couple posed for a seemingly endless amount of pictures. At receptions, they never got a chance to eat so much as an hors d'oeuvre. Standing the entire time in the horribly overheated room and struggling to stay awake, the president would play little pranks on guests he felt comfortable with. I almost felt guilty about getting a picture with him, but Jenny insisted. The four of us, myself, the first couple, and my wife, posed for a photo. I put my hand behind Mrs. Clinton, and immediately my hand was grabbed by a soft hand that placed it on Mrs. Clinton's rear. I was mortified and just froze. Snap. The picture was taken, and we thanked the president profusely, but were whisked away so the next couple could get their photo. I leaned over to Jenny. I think the president just put my hand on the first lady's bum. You think that was funny? The president kept, like, rubbing my back. Aghast, we didn't know what to make of it. We received the picture in the mail and still laugh about it. Everyone looks awkward, because we were. But don't get me wrong, that was classic President Clinton. He was never dull. The First Lady had a different sort of liveliness. She once threw a Bible at an agent on her detail, hitting him in the back of the head. He bluntly let her know it wasn't acceptable. He told me that story himself. Assignment to her detail was a form of punishment handed down by passive-aggressive middle management. She hated smokers, even seeing them. In high-stress jobs, even among her own staffers, smoking was popular. One of my UD buddies on the South Lawn always kept a single cigarette, a big long Benson and Hedges, for when Mrs. Clinton walked by. He would step out of his booth and light one up just so she could see him blowing big plumes. Without making eye contact, he would flick it so she saw it. When her detail passed, Mrs. Clinton expected everyone else to disappear. She didn't want to see anyone in the White House halls, as if the whole place were her personal executive mansion. It was insulting. People scurried as if in a giant game of hide and seek. An agent traveling ahead of her would direct people to disappear, usually into a nearby closet or alcove. Once, when the first couple stayed at a hotel, the SA ahead of their detail grabbed another officer and me to duck into a tiny, cramped, kitchenette-like area. "This is ridiculous," I complained. "Just the way it is, suck it up," said the agent. "What are we here for? How am I supposed to protect the president, her, or anyone else if I'm in a closet? Are we here to do a job or not?" I waited for the first couple's detail to radio when they approached before emerging to stand my post, to perform my duty. They passed. the First Lady ignored my existence. The SAs behind her glared at me as if they wanted me to spontaneously catch fire. "Big shot, huh?" said the agent, exiting the kitchenette. "Just doing my job," I said. "It's insulting that I should just disappear because the very sight of us bothers her." 8. Clinton World. When Bill Clinton arrived in January 1993, so did a new presidential chief of staff. Mac McLarty was a longtime Clinton friend and political ally from Hope, Arkansas, but he was simply in over his head in his new job, and he quickly lost control of a grossly immature White House staff, whose idea of propriety fluctuated somewhere between that of a political campaign office and of an empty pizza box-strewn college dorm. Sloppy, disrespectful Clinton staffers spilled so much coffee and soda in West Wing offices and hallways that the stains overwhelmed General Services Administration staff. GSA finally gave up on cleaning the carpets and replaced them wholesale. The president set the tone, wanting to keep his Oval Office door open all the time. That was his style. He'd welcome each colleague or staffer directly into the office, hearing them out directly. He loved granting everyone open access. But his approach destroyed any sense of hierarchy. Soon it obliterated what little sense of decorum had previously existed. It created chaos. Staffers often didn't see the need to go through his personal secretary, Betty Curry, or anyone at all. How the Clintons even managed to run Arkansas, I never knew. Betty and Appointments Secretary Nancy Hernreich found themselves shooing away his campaign staffers, who massaged their own egos by treating a sitting president of the United States like an old slap-on-the-back pal. Some kept referring to him as Governor or Bill rather than as Mr. President. At first, Mr. Clinton, a great schmoozer, enjoyed the laid-back camaraderie, but it wasted his time and left him unfocused. Staffers from all over the White House loved to loiter in the West Wing because it gave them a sense of being important and needed. The atmosphere made our hallways noisy and crowded. When things got tough, as when scandals needed clamping down, there were people everywhere. Early on, while Mac McLarty remained chief of staff, the president scheduled an Oval Office address to the nation. Cameras and teleprompters stood ready to roll. As the doors behind the president closed, a staffer came sprinting down the hallway. Her surname was Rodham, just like Hillary's maiden name, and she may have been a cousin of some sort. The Clintons seemed to like her. Usually I had no problems with her, other than having to remind her to wear her pass and keep it right side up. Today she was going too fast for me to worry about just her pass. Ms. Rodham was heading hell-bent for leather for the Oval Office. "Whoa, just stop," I ordered her, physically blocking her path. "Move," she commanded, maneuvering to get past me. "They're broadcasting. I can't let you in." I couldn't believe she would just barge in at will. "This is the correct speech," she fumed, waving a computer disk. "They have the wrong speech." I blocked her again. Her story didn't pass the smell test, on any level. "How could that be right?" I asked, and emphasized that by entering now, she'd risk jolting a cameraman and ruining a presidential address. She might even trigger a minor national panic if she knocked the camera over. I steered her over to Betty, whom I trusted to discreetly sort it all out. Thankfully, Ms. Rodham was wrong. It was she who had the wrong floppy disk. I wish that incident was unique. In July 1994, Leon Panetta replaced Mac McLarty. He cleaned house and restored order. The free world was safer, and so was the White House carpeting. Panetta was widely respected, and by reputation quiet, formidable, serious, passionate, neither a blowhard nor an ideologue. Our first interaction sent shivers down my spine. Inside the Roosevelt Room, Panetta conferred with Rahm Emanuel, George Stephanopoulos, and assorted other Clinton heavyweights. It was an informal meeting, and Panetta was getting a feel for everyone and letting it play out as if he were a fly on the wall. I saw someone with their feet propped up on a table. President Clinton entered, and Panetta stood to greet him. the only one to do so. The pair of feet resting on that table remained at ease. The president departed, and Panetta quietly ripped into his staff. I'll never forget it. I never heard him curse or yell, but he certainly had a way of being heard. The next time one of you doesn't stand when the president enters, I don't care what your reason is or what you did to get the president here, it is unacceptable. And that's all. The next day, the White House was more serious and focused, yet less frenzied, as if it was finally getting down to work. It was great. Someone had dared to issue marching orders. Panetta expected results. Congressional elections approached. It's strange how command and control structures take their cue from the top. The Clintons didn't create the political correctness movement, nor did they invent non-combative combatant mindset. But diversity encroached on merit. Professionalism degraded. As these plagues became more blatant, they became more contagious. Office promiscuity, DUIs, unprofessionalism, leadership from behind, and unethical behavior had all existed well before the Clintons. Now they accelerated. After the Clintons arrived, interoffice politics were exacerbated, not because of Panetta, but because of the president. On September 13, 1994, the federal assault weapons ban became law. It accomplished nothing beyond humoring gun control advocates. It protected no one. What difference did it make, to borrow a phrase from Mrs. Clinton, if the month before that a potential assassin like Francisco Duran attacked the White House with a regular SKS or the 1911? None. But what did I know? I was only trained in firearms by one of the most elite federal agencies. Leon Panetta walked up to me outside. Hey, officer, they're about to sign. You want to come in and see? Come on in. Thank you, Mr. Panetta, but I'm fine out here. It's not really uniformed division policy. Oh, come on. He waved me into the jam-packed Oval Office. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that, but to be honest, it's not really my cup of tea. I was honored, however, that he asked. He knew my name and thought to make small talk. He is a great man, and you bet I shared that story with other UD officers. I believe Leon Panetta genuinely placed America's well-being first and foremost. I never took his politics personally. While I did my job and kept my head down, a series of scandals tarnished the Clinton brand and presidency. They weighed on the administration, but they were never, at least then, my problem. They commenced, of course, long before Inauguration Day 1993. During the preceding election, a cabaret singer and former Little Rock TV news reporter named Jennifer Flowers revealed that she had been candidate Clinton's mistress for 12 years. Other women quickly emerged from the woodwork, stirring a media frenzy. Some were mistresses. Some alleged they were victims of sexual harassment, even rape. There were actresses, career businesswomen, and former employees. It seemed too strange not to be true, but not everyone believed them. The Clinton pattern was deny, deny, deny. Behind the scenes, the Clinton machine slut-shamed accusers, impugned their integrity, and supposedly even paid them off and intimidated them. The major scandal emerged in 1994. Paula Corbin Jones, an Arkansas state clerical employee, sued now President Clinton for sexual harassment. It all seemed like unpresidential celebrity news gossip. Again, this didn't involve me, so I didn't care. And then there was Whitewater, with a lot of money moving around in unethical ways. The Clintons had invested about $200,000 in Arkansas's Whitewater Development Corporation, losing $67,000 of it when the feds shuttered Whitewater for cooking its books and acting as a money laundering front for local politicians and favor-seeking businesses. How the Clintons could invest so much money while wallowing in $50,000 of campaign debt still mystifies me. Operating Whitewater was Jim McDougal, an Arkansas power player and former congressional candidate with ties to the Clintons, though supposedly he never involved either Clinton in his illegalities. To defend himself against federal charges, McDougal engaged Mrs. Clinton's former law firm, Little Rock's Rose Law Firm. Afterward, McDougal, out of the goodness of his heart, hosted a fundraiser to erase Clinton's campaign debts. Authorities finally convicted McDougal of multiple felony conspiracy charges. Other scandals followed. Meanwhile, a real under-the-media-radar, tough-on-corruption judge, Ken Starr, a man I later learned to both respect and loathe, took up the Whitewater investigation. I'd never heard of him before, but Starr's name soon was in every newspaper. He was a bloodhound, locking on the Clinton scent, though I still shrugged everything off as mere tall talk. Nothing revealed President Clinton's lax attitude toward his personal security more than his jogging routine. Nobody could get a straight answer from him on the Shakespearean question, to jog or not to jog. Nobody could. Not even the armored vehicle squad who would trail him if he did. Not the military liaison who safeguarded the nuclear football, the satchel enabling the president to launch a nuclear strike when away from the White House. Each morning, PPD and UD hovered near the executive residence entrance to spy his attire. Running clothes and sneakers or a suit? A suit, and we returned to our normal posts. We knew he was on his way to the Oval Office. Sneakers, and all hands on deck. Agents had to devise ways to jog with enough concealed firepower to protect him, and also to adapt to his spontaneous choice of route. Officers and agents had to adjust their PT schedule to his whim. We struggled to avoid endangering or snarling regular DC traffic while covering him as best we could. The service's version of SWAT teams stayed as close as possible, but it was a shit show. Once, UD officers stationed on the lawn spied President Clinton heading out for a jog, but his PPD wasn't in sight. A friend of mine on entry control duty pursued the president in full gear at breakneck speed until the PPD finally caught up with both of them. UD personnel made arrests, questioned suspicious people, and occasionally, when President Clinton outpaced his motorcade and his protecting agents, also sprinted after an essentially isolated and completely unprotected chief executive. He just didn't care. In his book, Within Arm's Length, Special Agent Dan Emmett even detailed a frightening near-assassination attempt during one of these reckless jogs. If, however, the president wasn't jogging, we hurriedly stowed our gear, redressed, returned the motorcade cars, PT'd if possible, and hiked back on regular posts all in a matter of minutes. A freaking nightmare. Finally, someone donated money for a private jogging track on the South Lawn's circular roadway. The First Lady also jogged. I was posted on the South Roadway, and she emerged from the executive mansion wearing a ball cap, gloves, gray sweatshirt, and black jogging pants. She was clearly fuming about something. Evergreen walking down South Lawn looking like she's heading to the gate, I heard in my ear from the officer at the gate. It sent the signal to me. Where's her SA detail? Be advised, FLPD, First Lady's Protective Detail, is aware. They're on their way. I can't forget the look on one of their faces. He was a big, muscular guy still wearing his suit. As he looked at us, rolled his eyes, and flung his hands up in the air, as if to say, "Here we go again." He sprinted across the lawn to catch up. A few more agents, still struggling to don jogging attire, followed his lead. Meanwhile, Mrs. Clinton neared an exit gate. The officer manning it agonized over what to do if she demanded that he open it, or whether he should abandon his post and fall in behind her if he did. Some agents literally went mad. Many turned to alcohol, drugs, performance enhancers, affairs, sometimes at the workplace, and even prostitutes and other dangerous habits. A effort mentality trickled down. Our intel briefings provided us with no-nonsense intelligence agency data on international and domestic terrorism developments. They always referenced Osama bin Laden. We also learned which morons had tried to hop the fence, attempted suicide at entry posts, or swung at a Secret Service agent, a Metro police officer, or a UD, and how each incident had unfolded. We discussed suspicious types snapping photos and the like. All of our national monuments and, Of course, the president were top terrorist targets. That's public knowledge. But much more remains classified. I can, however, disclose details of two very well-known events. I wasn't on post either day, for which my colleagues never ceased giving me crap. It was the evening of September 12, 1994. A good friend of mine, a Secret Service Emergency Response Team, ERT officer, I'll call Keith, guarded the south lawn. He spied a single-prop Cessna plane swooping just over the tree line, heading straight for him. After shitting his britches, Keith sprinted and hopped over some bushes to reach some safety alongside the building. That was all he could do. Bam! The Cessna crashed, wedging itself, contorted and mangled, against the doctor's office in the executive residence. Keith was the first to arrive at the crash. He yanked open the Cessna's door. The pilot's head had rotated nearly 180 degrees. He was obviously dead. Fuel poured over the lawn. But duty and training compelled Keith to check for a pulse. Posing as a tourist, the dead pilot, Frank Corder, had conducted a pre-advance, reconnoitering the ground from the south lawn fence line. Corder calculated distances, what dotted the ground, clearances, and so on. He wasn't trying to crash the plane or pull a suicide attack. He was trying to land the plane safely for an international stunt, copying daredevil German pilot Matthias Rust, who had taken off from Finland and landed in Red Square, Moscow, to expose Soviet vulnerabilities. Rust had been promptly arrested. Corder promptly died. Ironically, Corder posed relatively little immediate threat to the first family. With the White House undergoing renovations, the first family was temporarily residing across the avenue at Blair House. On October 29, 1994, a trench coat-clad man loitered by the North Lawn fence, a definite red flag. UD eyed him, but he hadn't yet reached reasonable suspicion level. Meanwhile, a political office staffer, instead of the usual tours section officer, detoured a special guest tour from its typical route to view the North Lawn staircase, a rare privilege and clearly outside of protocol. The UD officer manning the moat area warned that staffer against taking the tour through there. The staffer insisted. A tourist beyond the Pennsylvania Avenue fence line pointed at a tall, gray-haired man who was part of the tour group and screamed, "Look, there he is!" Francisco Martin Duran, the man in the trench coat, thought the gray-haired man was President Clinton. From under his coat, he whipped out a Chinese-made SKS magazine-fed rifle, spraying 29 AK-47 caliber rounds over the lawn and hitting the West Wing press lobby, where an officer scrambled to prevent the journalist from jumping out the window for a better view. "You can't stop us, we're the press," one shouted as he tried prying himself through a window. A bullet struck that window. A moment sooner, it could have struck him. Duran kept firing from the hip while jogging backward. There's a YouTube video of it. It was a panic. Even Duran wasn't sure whether to continue firing or to escape. With any tactical training, he could have easily gunned down several of the officers or even the president, if that gray-haired man really were the president. Officers didn't have a clear shot. What you can't see in the video are civilians near Duran freezing and running after the shock of the gunfire. Out of ammunition, Duran dropped his magazine on the sidewalk and retrieved another from his coat pocket. Three civilian bystanders tackled him. Watch the YouTube home video vacation footage turned impromptu assassination evidence, and you'll see a man in a comically tall and wide cowboy hat tackle Duran, exhibiting zero regard for his own life and safety. What most people don't know is this. That Texan was ironically well known to us as a frequent White House caller who demanded to see the president. I'd dealt with him before, but that day he rose above and beyond the call of any civilian's duty. Officers cornered Duran, their guns pointed squarely at his head. Among them was a UD ERT officer who had vaulted the fence. We called him Flying Harry, and he was a workplace friend and later an SA. Instead of returning fire through the fence, Flying Harry bolted headlong over it, to isolate his own field of fire and to safeguard White House visitors. He, along with the three civilians who reacted without any training to run toward the fight, were heroes. Secret Service higher-ups told Congress that the Duran incident resulted from a lack of funds and from not being permitted to secure a wider perimeter. But what the UD did that day was exactly what it was trained for. There was no friendly fire, no deadly mistaking civilians for assassins. Everything went according to plan. Well, mostly according to plan. It was, however, a massive learning experience. The lack of a common radio network cost us a few seconds of reaction time. In a perfect world, we should have checked Duran sooner. But we weren't there to check everyone with a bulge in their pocket and a big belly, though some in the Secret Service wanted it that way. Another acquaintance of mine also hopped the fence that day and ended up holding a bystander at gunpoint. That wasn't a mistake. That was actually necessary diligence. We can't assume just one shooter. The bystander later told the FBI that he could hear and see the hammer decock on the officer's SIG pistol. You can bet there were a lot of itchy trigger fingers at the White House that day. Yes, days like that shatter complacency, until things settle down again. Following Francisco Duran's failed attempt, everyone submitted his or her own report for evidence. A UD officer on the portico, I'll call him Henry, raced toward the gunfire, ending up near where officers collared Duran. When Henry submitted his report to his lieutenant, henceforth known as the editor, he was pressured to change his statement. To lie. The editor absurdly believed that Henry should have remained at his post and not chased the gunfire. An absolutely ridiculous idea. He handed Henry a doctored report. Henry refused to sign it. Later, when prosecutors were preparing their case against Duran, they requested that officers review their reports. Again, that's just routine due diligence. Henry reviewed his. "Yeah, I thought this might be a problem," he responded. "What do you mean?" "That's not my statement. This is my statement," he said, producing his original, undoctored report. Henry had anticipated that the editor would proceed with filing a falsified report. Higher-ups reamed out the editor. Word of his offense traveled as high as the director of the agency. Had federal prosecutors presented a falsified statement, their whole case could have been questioned. As strange as it seems, Duran could have gotten away with it. That's why the quality of being worthy of trust and confidence remains pivotal for the Secret Service. The editor kept his job and even filed a lawsuit a few years later for not being promoted. The service should have shit-canned him immediately. But it wanted the story squashed and couldn't if it had fired him. On the presidential staff side, the scandals never ended. Staffers remained on high alert, but facing a constant barrage of daily headlines, they failed to focus on clear priorities. I almost felt bad for them. Many were good people trying to do right. They didn't seek the limelight. I can empathize with that. They just wanted to serve their country's leadership and implement their common vision. I can respect that, too. Once, the president's national security advisor emerged from Betty Curry's office after presenting a briefing. Making a sharp left turn, he looked distinctly off-kilter. Proceeding gingerly down the hallway, he shifted his papers to his left hand, touching everything with his right. The furniture, the walls, the door to the Roosevelt room, the table, the plant on it, the credenza, and the next door jamb. He looked as if he was losing it. I did not envy him. Conversely, President Clinton's cool cucumber personality impressed me. Nothing seemed to get him down. He was pure Teflon, always displaying a good positive humor. It helps explain his incredible magnetism. He just had a magical way about him. Maybe it was his radio voice or his James Bond-like demeanor. My father could fix a rock. President Clinton could charm a rock. If the president told me my name wasn't Gary Byrne, I'd have to check my name tag, I told people. If I had only one way to describe President Clinton, that was it. I once needed to write up an incident that occurred in the fence line area. It was the midnight shift, and I asked the control clerk, a UD officer, if she could type the document for me. I confided to her how nervous I normally was about writing or typing anything, how I certainly didn't want my dyslexia to screw up a legal document. She was glad to help. When she handed me the finished document, she advised me that our watch commander was still at his old executive office building office. If I hurried, I'd catch him right in time. I was still a new guy to the job. So naive. I raced to his office and knocked twice. Not waiting for an answer, I swung his door open and froze. What I saw was not good. His office lights were off, but hallway lights allowed me to see what I didn't want to see. Him screwing a female sergeant on the desk. I'll come back later. I closed the door much faster than I opened it. Taking into account their, position and his office's dim light, I hoped they didn't recognize me. But the hallway light silhouetted me, and my height and build were fairly noticeable. I later passed the super in the hallway and made small talk. I made a mental note to remember to forget what I saw. But I never forgot the look on that control clerk's face when I next saw her. It was an expression of pure satisfaction. She had placed me in an incredibly difficult spot with both my watch commander and my sergeant, severely damaging team dynamics. Every grievance I might have had in the future, I very well might attribute to their character flaws. A pretty easy case to make when you see management screwing other officers on their desk. I came to believe that that control clerk hoped I'd spread the word. Hey guys, I walked in on... I didn't dare. I didn't blab. Power corrupts, as they say. Leon Panetta pondered such matters in his book, Worthy Fights, a memoir of leadership in war and peace. 90% of the personalities who get into the White House are hotshot types. They're overzealous about everything they do, relationships, sex, money, nightlife, and power. And everything gained by power can be used to gain more of it. I didn't catch on quickly enough that sex was a part of that. But I caught on enough to know it was trouble and to abstain. People got transferred. Careers got ruined. Most important, favoritism, drama, and distractions hampered the mission. I was serving on post during a photo op for an SA who was leaving the PPD. Before retiring or being transferred, agents, but not UD officers, could pose for a photo with their families and the president. It meant a lot to them. This agent, however, was being transferred to what might as well have been Siberia, punishment for his general office drama and for various other behavioral issues. The Secret Service was saving itself an embarrassment. Being the genius that he was, this hotshot asked me to ward off so-and-so, his mistress. What the hell was I supposed to do? Sweep a broom at her feet? Cold cock her? She had a White House pass and was even part of the Arkansas Mafia. I spent the next half hour or so nervously watching the members of this unholy love triangle eye each other with open scorn. I just prayed, please don't let this blow up in front of the president's face. Stuff like that happened far more than it should. Why? Because superiors told us one thing and did another. Leadership, in both the service and the administration, often conveyed the message that bad behavior was truly bad only if it made headlines. I called it the Caesar mentality, do as I say, not as I do, or off with your head. Who could take the orders seriously when rumors flew that even the president was having midnight calls of his own? Increasingly, I had reason to pray. Please don't let this blow up in front of the president's face.